Welcome to the Death with Dignity podcast, episode 1. My name is Andrew Flack, and I will be your host. In this episode, I will share with you my experiences with cancer, as well as the current prognosis. I will also talk with our co-producer, Hasban, as we discuss the history of Death with Dignity, or the End of Life Option Act. Together, we will explore the physical, social, emotional, and spiritual elements related to the Death with Dignity process. We thank you for joining us on this journey and hope you appreciate the first episode. All right. Well, welcome everybody. Kind of hard to believe that this is our first episode. This has been a work in progress for quite a while. We've been putting a lot of different pieces together, and yeah, it's exciting to be here and get things going.
Yeah. Even though this is episode number one, it's actually not the first episode that we're recording. So yeah, it's kind of crazy to see where the podcast has arrived to. It's a start off as an idea based on a couple of conversations. And yeah, we're at an interesting point now.
Yes, so you heard from the introduction that our goal for this episode is to essentially give you an idea as to who I am as an individual. My name's Andrew Flack, as mentioned in the introduction. And, well, basically right now I do have cancer. But I don't like to necessarily start with that because, you know, you don't want to just be like, oh, there's Andrew, the guy with cancer, you know. I've always prided myself as a teacher. I teach special education, take pride in that. Obviously, being close with my family and friends, that's something that you try to maintain those relationships and be there for the people who are important to you. And then big hockey individual. Actually, I started playing hockey because the first time I was sick with cancer, I was 4 years old, and that's all I wanted to do. We had actually been living in England at the time, and we had some friends. We had a couple different friends over there, even though we didn't know anybody. We made friends through the school community. We had gone to an American school. It was called the American Community School, but essentially it was a school that hosted students from all over the world, K through 12 services, really cool experience. So there was a large American community there, or American families, and one of them they were Canadian, and they were Calgary fans, the Calgary Flames. And I remember my buddy Justin, he always had a Calgary Flames jersey on, and they were big hockey people, and that kind of always stuck out. That's when I guess when I was sick, you know, that's what I wanted to do, was learn how to skate and play hockey. So that's the last piece I like to think about as a big part of who I am, hockey player. And granted, of course, not a professional by any means, but I've played at a decent level, I'd say, and regardless of if you're playing for your first time lacing them up or you're playing in the NHL, I've said it before, but I think we hockey players, tight-knit community, cut from a different cloth, and at any level you can really appreciate that game. So, yeah. And then, obviously, as I mentioned too, right now I do have cancer. This is the second time that I've been sick. The first time I was 4 years old when I was diagnosed, and the second time many years later at age 27, I was diagnosed with a different type of cancer, unrelated.
Yeah, you've talked about it a lot, that like hockey is how you, or what you go back to when you think of like what you have to do and how you have to deal with cancer. And yeah, I'm glad that you talked about the other aspects of your identity. It sucks to be identified with something like cancer. I feel like when I think of you, I mean, obviously you have a disease, but I think of the hockey part, the friends and family, you're definitely really good at maintaining relationships. Probably one of the, yeah, you really value relationships, and we all know they take a lot of work, and you're just friends with so many people. And one of the cool things has been, obviously the cancer is more of a reason for people to come see you, and it's amazing how many people have actually visited the Nevada house, and what a, like a diversity of friends and family you have, and you have really unique like relationships with a lot of people.
Yes, I'm very very fortunate. A lot of different people in my life cross paths with some real beauties, and it's been a journey. And even though this situation is pretty brutal, you never want to be in this situation with a terminal disease, but you reflect and think about how you got here and the people who've helped you got here, and I still really have strong belief that the universe has a plan for us all, and this is just part of that plan, and for whatever reason, this is the path I'm supposed to be on, and that's okay. It's okay, I've accepted that. It took a long time to figure that out, but I've accepted it, and I know that I'm not going to live till I'm, you know, 40, 50, 80, anything like that, but I feel I've lived a couple lifetimes with the wild stuff that I've done and the experiences I've had in my short 33 years. So despite the lack of time on this planet, it's okay. I think we get stuck measuring a good life based on time. We're so stuck on time. Yeah. And that is all we have, right?
A lot of things are based on time, even like relationships, which I feel like that's just like a number you put weight on. I feel like before we go further, I think there's one aspect of your identity that you didn't touch on. You're also a gamer.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Gaming. Love playing video games. That is very true. Related to video games. My parents didn't get us a system until I was in, I think, fourth or fifth grade. So I always said that they had deprived me as a child, and that's why I'm still gaming hard as an adult. But gaming culture is so much different now versus when we were growing up. You people understand there, you can make a profession out of it, and you can make really good money out of it.
You can be a 30-year-old with kids, family, and still be gaming nowadays. Back like 20 years ago, it was just a thing that like a certain subset of people did, but now women, men,
yeah, very accessible. All ages,
yeah, everyone is gaming. They got their own thing going.
Yeah, so I take pride in gaming. In fact, one of my really good friends from middle school was just visiting, and him and I used to really battle in Halo. We were reminiscing about the glory days. I'm trying to get him back online. But yeah, like gaming too, for sure. It's a fun way to pass the time, and usually when I game as well, I'm gaming with my buddies. So it's guys like Hazman and some good friends. So that makes it way more fun. It's kind of like a social thing. We get to chit chat and catch up.
Yeah,
as well.
The conversations we have gaming are some of my favorite conversations. Whether it's about the type of pizzas, toppings on pizzas, a lot of pizza talk, but just generally all things about life. We try to solve the world's problems while trying to kill some bad guys.
Yeah, basically. It's pretty awesome. But yeah, those are some of the pieces. And I had to think as well, because actually, did I do the math wrong? Now I'm thinking again. Oh yeah, okay. So I was actually, my second diagnosis was at age 29, not 27. For a second, I forgot how old I was, but
that happens.
Yeah, 4 years. Actually, October 3rd of 2017 was when I was diagnosed for the second time with At the time, it was a stage 3 colorectal cancer. It had spread to the lymph nodes in that area in the pelvic region and just kind of throughout that area, I suppose. So into some other valuable parts of the body. But yeah, 4 years. It's been a while grinding with this.
Yeah, from the first time to the second time. I mean, the first time you probably don't like remember as much. I mean, you probably didn't think about it too much during your life. And then, yeah.
Yeah, when I was young, I have very few memories, only a couple that are pretty specific and I think probably accurate. But I think regardless, you know, it's still something that you hold on to and is with you for a long time. And I think at that age, it shapes you, whether you know it or not, it shapes you.
For sure. It was really interesting hearing your mom speak about it, which people can check out episode number 2. And yeah, because I mean, I knew that you had something before, but to hear your mom talk about it, I mean, it was definitely like an ordeal and probably prepared you in many ways for all the, you know, hardships that you faced throughout your life.
Yes, certainly. And then you combine that with going back to the game of hockey and how we hockey players, we like to think we're the toughest customers out there. And there's some truth to that as well. I think it just kind of compounds in a way. And from those experiences, you're able to apply them to what's going on right now in my life. And again, it's reinforcing to me that this is the path we're supposed to be on. And even though it's pretty obnoxious, some of the stuff that's going on with my body, it's supposed to be me and it's supposed to be happening.
I know we talk, we're going to talk about the physical, social, emotional, and the spiritual side of things. And then as you were talking, one thing I was thinking about is like, you're talking openly about it here and I'm sure it's not your favorite thing to talk about. So how does it feel when people like ask you about it? I'm sure people are like, curious and you probably, yeah, sometimes you probably just answer to be nice.
Right. It's hard relating to people how severe the disease really is. I mentioned before that I am now a stage 4 cancer patient, which means that the disease has spread for me throughout my pelvic region and is attacking other areas of the body, such as the bladder, prostate. It's also been found in my tailbone. And when disease spreads to your tailbone, any bone, I should say, not necessarily tailbone, but when it gets to the bone, that's not good. With cancer, the best way to remove it is, or to treat it is by removing it, and obviously you can't remove bones generally. But when people ask, I just try to frame it and explain that we're maintaining and just trying to maintain my current health because I do look pretty good, right? Everyone always says, wow, you look great. And I don't know. I always chuckle about that stuff.
I feel like they have a picture in their head, you know?
Right.
And also, you can't really see beyond someone's clothes.
For sure.
To be real.
For sure. And it is true. When you think of somebody with cancer, you generally think of, you know, someone bald and very frail and probably weak and fatigued. And I've certainly been to those. I've been in those states and I have been in situations over the last 4 years where I've had one foot in the grave, but somehow managed to kind of bounce back. And now I've got some glorious, beautiful, flowing locks. And, I laugh about that because I always, today, even at work, a guy was like, man, I still can't get over that hair. And I said, that's what a pandemic will do to you. You go in looking like George Clooney and come out looking like this. So certainly, I don't necessarily fit the picture of somebody who is dying from the disease of cancer. I don't think you would really think that at first glance. You would look and notice a few things. For example, I use a medical device called a nephrostomy tube, and that is basically a bag of urine that is a tube. Basically, a tube connects from my kidney to this bag, and then I'm able to urinate through the bag. And that's there because it's extremely difficult to urinate naturally. I still do that a couple times a day, and I will say they're the worst parts of my day. I mean, it's a 10-minute process to take a pee, and it feels like someone's beating me in the abdomen with a sledgehammer. So it's pretty miserable. So the nephrostomy tube kind of helped bail me out, because as the disease was progressing, the body was breaking down. I was needing to, you know, urinate more and more, and it got to the point where I was going like 25, 30 times a day. And imagine doing that and feeling that horrible 25 or 30 times a day for, you know, 10, 20 minutes at a time. So basically, this thing was a silver lining, because I certainly would have kicked off. I would have chosen to use this medication had I had to do that every day. Again, it's very painful, very uncomfortable. And that's just part of the disease. It's a horrible disease, and it pretty much makes your body rot from the inside out.
As far as like the physical side of it, I feel like as somebody that's lived with you throughout this, you've been like there's been a whole like spectrum of your physical health. I mean, I have seen you at points where it didn't seem, yeah, you did look like that patient that you kind of described, except the hair was good, but you know, sometimes you're weak, sometimes you're strong. It seems like physically it's been a ride.
Yes, it's a grind every day. I do try to remind people, again, I do look good. I feel pretty good for the most part. There are certain things that have been occurring recently, which I know are probably not good things for my body. But I try to remind people that with this disease, it's a slippery slope, and you can be doing pretty good one day, and then all of a sudden, something's a little off, you're not feeling so hot, then the next thing you know, you're in the hospital, and then your body's just breaking down, and you kick off. I mean, I think when you start to go with this disease, it's usually a pretty quick process. When you get to a certain point, it's almost like you reach a point, and then it's just like, okay, let's check out.
Yeah, there's probably a critical point for the body, too, where it's just like too many things are like happening at once. But I guess like one of the questions I had for you is like kind of a combo question, but like, how have you learned to deal? I know you're a hockey player, but how have you learned to deal with the physical effects? And, yeah, I mean, I bet it differs from day to day, like you were talking about, but I guess, is there any like advice that you would have for people dealing with like similar physical ailments?
I think everyone has their own process and perspective with this stuff, and their own way of doing things and getting by. And I think whatever works for you is what you got to go with. But I know for me, well, one, I'm fortunate because I've had very good pain management and doctors working with me to help control some of those side effects and symptoms. So staying up on your meds and following through with those pieces are huge. And then in terms of some of those other rougher days, you just got to grind through and just keep. For me, a lot of the motivation is like if those days were, or weekends or whatever it is, where I end up, you know, getting sick, and then at UCSD, and then you're in there for, you know, 3, 4, sometimes 10 days at a time. I find internal motivation when I'm there specifically, just in that I got to get the hell out of here and see a lot of people before I'm ready to go. And with the other pieces, you really try to enjoy the good days when you're feeling physically well and appreciate that and know that it might not be this way in a few hours.
Yeah, I think the, yeah, I feel like I've seen you go through a process. That's really cool that you're like grounded with something. And yeah, when you're at the hospital, there's just this feeling. I mean, you want to get the hell out of there. That's like motivation within, like in itself. Is there any other thoughts you had about the physical like aspects?
I just, throughout this experience, I'm learning a lot about the disease of cancer, and it is so complex, it's absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So when I think about the physical pieces and how it impacts the body, it's just, it's hard to believe that it's really your body revolting against itself, a civil war within, between these cells, and for whatever reason, they don't want to cooperate. No one knows why. No one would ever choose this. It's not like I woke up one day and said, hey, I think I'll decide to get cancer today. It's a horrible thing, and you just got to try to stay up. And with that, too, the support and the people I've had have been absolutely tremendous, and without them, certainly would not be in this position right now. But yeah, holding on to the good things. That's what I'm trying to do.
Speaking of the people in your life, like, has your relationship with your like family and loved ones? I'm sure it has changed, but I guess how has it changed?
Yeah, for me, I think your priorities, you realign those and recognize what's more important than other things. I've kind of recognized and tried to let go of just silly things from past experiences or old grudges or something, which I guess, I don't know, I guess I never really have had a grudge against anyone per se, but you recognize what's important and you look back and reflect on your own actions and realize you learn about yourself and just silly things and little things that I think add up over time. But I think another big piece that I'm learning from this emotionally is how to kind of recognize what is an actual problem versus what isn't really a problem. Sometimes we kind of create our own problems in life, it seems like.
Yeah, I feel like the mind is a problem creator.
Yeah, it seems that way. So trying to remember what's important, trying to just smile and be happy and be in the moment, as cliche as that is, but getting to the beach and just listening to the waves, using your senses, hearing the sounds, smelling the ocean air, feeling that cool breeze. Yeah, all those little things, those are what's really important to me and kind of help make things move forward.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. Real quick, though, in terms of the relationship with family, I think this whole thing has brought us closer together. And I give specifically my parents a lot of credit for how they've handled and supported me throughout this whole experience. They've really, really stepped up, along with my sisters and many friends. But if anything, with this horrible disease, it certainly has brought us closer.
Yeah, there's like not, there's always a silver lining in everything. And obviously, the disease might have shortened your time, but it may have enhance it in like a lot of ways, and I've seen you guys all interact. It's really cool and beautiful.
Yeah, and my sisters are starting to have children and raise their own families, and it's really amazing to see and be a part of, and they all have amazing people or amazing men that they are with and married to, and I am so grateful for those individuals. And I take a lot of comfort knowing that they are there so that when it is my time to go, I know that they're going to be okay and they're really well taken care of. That's what I've always been afraid of most during this process, is not as much for myself, but really just for my family and what will transpire when all this does, you know, finally end for me. But over the years, as I've gone through this, they've been with me each step of the way and showed me tremendous strength. And that's, you know, I now realize that they're just as strong as anybody else and they're going to be okay.
Yeah. Like I said, it's just really cool how people come together. I think in the tough moments in your life, whether it's the disease or just something that like happened to you, you know, when you're really going through something, you really find out who's there for you and like, you know, who's your day one. And, you know, there's something really just cool about that, how we rely on other people. And I know you have so many friends that are, you know, family for you. As far as the social, like emotional goes, I feel like you have like evolved emotionally. You know, there's like a process of getting news. And I mean, the thing with like cancer, it seems to be like a full-time job, just managing it, besides the fact that you actually all right now are back at a full-time job. Yeah. How did you learn to deal with the mental challenge, I guess? And how did it like evolve?
Yes, it certainly is exhausting, and I try not to think about the situation too much. Don't confuse that with denial, because I am very aware of my situation, prognosis, and what's going on with my body. But what good does it do to sit around all day thinking about how you're dying from cancer? I mean, sure. Who wants to really do that, right? Anyways. Yeah, like it's so far out of my control that, I mean, there's nothing I can do. I mean, what choices do you have, right? You just got to go. You got to keep going on. So you push forward. It's okay to feel sad and feel those emotions. And I've felt them and I've been brought to my knees. And it's been certainly a roller coaster of those things. And you need to feel them out. It's a part of the process. But eventually you get to that point where you accept what's going on and you just do, you make the most out of things. I was just going to mention too, going back to the physical and even emotional piece here as well. One thing I try not to do is compare my disease and my physical self with others and other people's ailments. I noticed when I first got sick, a lot of people would, you know, we'd just be talking, coworker or friend or whoever, and they might be telling me about their problem, the problem they're having. And maybe it's something physical, like, oh, I had a cold last week and it was brutal. And then they would say, oh, but I'm sorry, I shouldn't be complaining.
I know I've done that to you with you.
Right. Well, I guess they say I shouldn't be complaining. And whether you have an obnoxious cold or you're sick with cancer, when you have a problem, you have a problem. It's obnoxious either way. And certainly there are varying degrees of it, but I don't want to compare myself and my disease with someone who has a cold. I think that leads to negativity and you don't need any more of that in life. And I don't want to, you don't want to put someone else down. Like I said, a problem's a problem. That's why they're called problems, because they suck and they interfere with things. So not comparing yourself with others in this situation is something that I learned, I think, pretty early to try to not do.
Yeah, that makes sense, though. Some people's problems are sometimes really stupid.
Well, yeah, and you think, too, like, you recognize, too, And it helps with your own self because you think, like, is this really a problem or am I just being silly right now? And then I realize with most of my, quote, problems, I am just being silly. And so you kind of reflect and recognize, no, that's not really a problem. Let's, you know, fix it and just move on in life.
Yeah, one thing, it's kind of, I guess it's still on the same topic, but, like, one thing that you've spoken about, and I think we did on one of the podcasts too, maybe on one of the outtakes, but is the fact that you felt like this was meant for you to happen, so it didn't happen to anybody else in your family. And then we kind of got to talking about how, like, you've been such a, like, a, it's almost like you are energy for everybody else, you know, because you're able to maintain such positivity throughout this. And I, when I talk to people, I always tell them, like, what the most amazing thing is that you've been able to be positive throughout, you know, and not just let it get you down. So yeah, it's not really a question, but more of a thought that, yeah.
I think you've been this
person for the entire community of people that you know.
Right. And yeah, thank you for that recognition. And like I said earlier, I've had plenty of pity parties, and it is important to feel emotions and feel that sadness and anger and all of it. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to do that all the time and just waste my life away with the little time I have left. And I hope if people can gain something positive from seeing what's going on in my life, then that's a good thing. And as you mentioned, I do feel like it just has to be me. And I hope, my hope has always been, and I guess I'll never really know, but that in a way I'm cutting some kind of deal with the universe or whoever is in control. And we'll talk about that at some point, but that because I'm going through this, I'm really hoping it does. Nothing like this ever happens to people that I care about, family, friends. And yeah, I'm okay. If that's what this all means, and in the end, everyone, you know, will be good. That's all right then. I'll take that deal.
Yeah, that's and a really
I'll be the
cool
person to outlook. Yeah, to go with it.
Yeah,
maybe that's me just trying to rationalize all this, but like I said, everyone has their own process and just has to do what they do to get by.
Well, it's a fact that you do, by the way that you've, you know, led a life of a dignity that you have, and even doing this podcast about very tough topics, I think you really have uplifted, like, a lot of people. It's kind of a spark, and, you know, sometimes even just knowing somebody who has that kind of courage can give you courage, and, yeah.
Absolutely. I hope so.
I guess the spiritual part is something we haven't touched on. I'll let you start off if you want to say anything.
Sure,
specific.
Yeah. I suppose for those listening, how we kind of perceive this podcast, we're investigating those three different pieces, were the physical components, things like how cancer impacts the body, as well as social, emotional, what your own mental process is like with this disease, how it impacts you emotionally and others emotionally, and also socially in your own life and people around you, and how this disease, like I said, plays a part in that social piece of life. And then the last piece as well, the spiritual component. And this is one that I've always been really fascinated with. I remember being a little kid is some of my earliest memories. I remember being like probably 5 years old in church. I was raised Catholic for a number of years, went to Catholic school for a few years. And basically just wondering, like at the time, wondering, what is this all about? Who's Jesus? Who is this guy? And what's going on, basically? And it was a fascinating experience with Catholicism. But I think I always knew that it wasn't really for me. I had never felt very comfortable in that environment, and I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. If that's your cup of tea, that's fine. Enjoy it. To each his own, and I will support you as long as you are supportive and respectful back and not hurting anyone. But I guess where I'm going with this is, I guess I right now, the last few years, I kind of call it more the universe. That's how I look at things. I believe in some sort of divine being, higher power, whatever you want to call it, God. I don't know what it is exactly, but I do personally believe that there is going to be more. And to me, it just feels like there's too many things that are too great to be coincidence in this life. And yeah, that's kind of how I've been feeling and navigating. Just let the universe unfold.
Yeah. The universe is going to do what the universe is going to do.
And we're excited to talk more with different guests related to, I guess, that spiritual piece. For example, different chaplains and people in that field. One of the top, as you can imagine, this is a very controversial topic. The End of Life Option Act, or Death with Dignity, is what some people refer to it as. But there are different organizations and different religions who do not agree with this option. So certainly that impacts individuals who are like me and sick with this disease and sick with other types of diseases as well.
Yeah. Do you want to, I don't know if you have anything else on the spiritual part, but maybe we can get into the history of Death with Dignity.
Sure. Yeah, the only other thing with the spiritual component that I'd like to share, and I know a lot of people are going to chuckle and laugh about this, but for me, my greatest spiritual moments of enlightenment were when I was using psilocybin or psychedelic mushrooms. And those experiences are very, very hard to convey to others. They're a very personal thing. Very powerful as well. And I think if you've been in that state of mind, you probably would agree that some of those experiences might have been the most profound in terms of spirituality or theology or religious beliefs or whatever you want to consider it. But I guess for what I'm getting at is that when in that state of mind, I've had some really unique experiences, and they help kind of learn more about yourself as a person and your own self and your mind and body and all of it. So you learn a lot, and it just reinforces my belief that this is all playing out as it should and that we're going in the direction we should be and down the path we should be. Sometimes, though, I will say, I do think we might be in a simulation. I'm a fan of the simulation theory. And basically, maybe this is just a huge, we're in a computer program, a video game, The Sims, if you will, being operated by a different user, or God, if you will. And really, it's just all computer-generated. I was talking about this with a friend, and he had said that's a great idea, and the top processing speed would be the speed of light, is what he said, since that's as fast as the highest speed we know in this universe. So he thinks that's the highest speed for the computer that we're operating under. Anyways, we've said this a few times during our episodes. That's for another podcast, people. We'll save that for a later episode. But we'll continue with our overall, and
I had one question about the spiritual part. So with the psychedelics, just to ask one question,
sure.
They always talk about set and setting, And you obviously have done them while you knew about the disease, right?
Yes.
Do you want to speak about that at all? I feel like that's a unique moment in...
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Because that was probably the most profound experience with psychedelics I've had. But it was back, I believe, in 2019. It was shortly after one of my major surgeries. And I was with some friends. I was in a tremendous amount of pain from the surgery, which was probably 3 to 4 weeks prior. Significant amount. I mean, some of the worst pain at that time that I had ever experienced. Was pretty limited in what I was doing. And which really that means I was basically posted up on the couch. At that time, I was sleeping on the couch because my bed was not comfortable for me. Anyways, we decided to do some... Oh, speaking of, and then that night I got my new mattress. So this, yeah, I wasn't, no, sorry, that's a, anyway, so we decided, I was with some friends and we decided to make some mushroom tea, give it a whirl. We loaded it up without realizing it to a pretty high level and had consumed much more than we anticipated. So it was a very, very profound and powerful trip. But during that time, physically, I was able to get up. And literally, I was dancing. We had music on. I was able to get up and move and dance. And I felt so good physically and naturally, emotionally as well. It was incredible. It was medicine that was more powerful than any other painkiller or any other prescription I had ever been given. In that moment, when I was using those psychedelics for those probably 4 to 6 hours, it was almost like I was cancer-free, and it was a pretty amazing experience. Thanks for asking that, because that's something that I'd like to expand on, literally maybe in another podcast someday. Yeah. But the power, they call them magic mushrooms for a reason, people. They are pretty damn magical, and we've talked, but I do believe in 10, 20 years, they are going to be a pretty... maybe 30 years, pretty accessible, acceptable, and mainstream treatment for a lot of different diseases and problems.
But what are the effects you felt? They didn't just last for the duration of the trip. You were physically feeling better even after you were off, right?
Yeah, physically I was feeling better. I was physically feeling better, but when I came down from the mushrooms, the pain was still there, but I think during that time when I was relieved and released from that state of cancer in a way, I was able to tap in spiritually. I was able to reflect heavily, and I was in a situation where I was brought to my knees and had an extreme and profound connection with myself as a person on this planet and with more than what we experience here. It felt like connections with maybe other realms, entities, beings, energies. It's hard to explain, but certainly I remember after that evening, I had reached out to my family, and I was in such a negative state at that time because it was shortly after the relapse with cancer, and it was after we found out that the disease essentially was terminal. So naturally you're pretty depressed. I was in a depressed state, and that experience with the psychedelics woke me up from that state, and it brought me back to reality in this realm, and it helped me realize what I needed to do and how I needed to operate in order to stay alive and to manage this disease. So there were a lot of pretty profound experiences and just instrumental in how that experience kind of has shaped me with my journey with cancer.
Yeah, that's like amazing to actually like hear about. And
I've done a little journaling on it, and we've talked as well about possibly expanding on it, maybe like a short story or a book or something, or even like a podcast episode about that specific evening, because it was just tremendous in what occurred. But again, yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because that was a big, big piece to where I'm at and how I'm here.
I know I asked that like a question because I wasn't sure if you'd want to dive deep or if we would have to cut that out. But I was also partaking that night, and yeah, I just felt like you had this weight lifted off, at least for that moment. You know, like there's like this energy that you probably were carrying after hearing all that news, and it was amazing to see like just the mood that it put you in that positive state. And I remember you just telling me that was like, yeah, that was a really amazing and profound experience.
Yeah. It's crazy. It gives me the chills just thinking about it. I mean, and again, thank you for bringing that up. The hardest part about all that is holding on to it and remembering and revisiting those experiences and remembering how powerful it was and how it did happen, and it was something that I can continue to build off of. So holding on to those feelings and those emotions and that time to reflect is important, and it's important to apply to what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Should we talk about death with dignity? Since this podcast is called the Death with Dignity Podcast.
Yes. Yes. Let's get into it a little bit. We mentioned to the listeners that I'm at a point with my disease where they will not be able to cure my cancer. It will likely kill me as it continues to get worse and spread. A lot of that information and how I got to this point, because trust me, friends, it has been a roller coaster. We talk a lot about that in episode 2. So feel free to give that a listen. That's also with my mom as a guest, and she does a great job talking about my experiences when I was a child with cancer as well, because as a child, I was also a stage 4 cancer patient, managed to get by that, and as mentioned, many years later, diagnosed again. And it's been a trip. I mean, even during this experience for 4 years, there was a point where I was considered cancer-free, and they had thought, my doctors and team thought, we're good. Like, we got rid of it all. He's good. There's no more. We're moving on in life. And then 3 months after that, I had a relapse with the cancer, and it was back. And that's immediately when we knew how severe and how hardcore this disease was, that it was very aggressive and likely very unique and rare in the mutations with the disease. So I'm in a place now, and we do know we've done what's called a molecular profile, and that basically breaks down your tumor and explains what type of mutations are in the cells causing this to develop a tumor. And we know that some of the mutations that I have with my cancer are very, very rare, and they're very, very difficult to treat. And there really just aren't treatments out there yet to combat these mutations. And that's why it will continue to spread and eventually kill me. However, there are options even when you are in a place as a cancer patient with a terminal disease. And in California, it's called the End of Life Option Act. And that law gives people with a terminal disease the opportunity to end their life in a humane and dignified manner. And that's what we're here to talk about, is the death with dignity process and those different pieces, the spiritual, social, emotional, and physical elements involved.
How did you first find out about the option?
Yeah, I was in the hospital, and I was in, it was probably the second time in like a month or two that I was back in. And the body, I remember I had dropped down to 112 pounds. The body was just breaking down. I was in bad shape. And for the record, when I moved to California, I weighed about 150. So recently, since being sick, my baseline and stable weight is probably 130. So when you go from about 130 pounds or 130 or so, really 150 down to 112 at one point in your life. That's a lot of weight to lose. So
yeah, you became tiny.
Yeah, I was pretty banged up in the hospital. I was talking with my oncologist, and we already knew at that point that the disease was essentially terminal and not very treatable. And I was very frustrated, I remember initially, with the team. And I think really just for a lack of understanding, because I probably wasn't really as accepting at that point as to my situation. But being frustrated with my doc, and he came in and we were talking quite a bit. And, you know, I was talking to him just about where I was going and what options we had and if there was anything more we could do. And when we were talking about the options piece, he did bring up the idea of death with dignity. It's to make it very clear, first of all, it's not something that he forced on me. It was a natural part of our discussion at the time. And he basically explained to me what death with dignity is and what it contains in terms of medication, how the process works. And it is a pretty intricate process. It's not so intricate that you don't want to follow through with it. It's not something that is like grueling, like you think, oh man, I got so much paperwork to do for this. They make it very manageable for people who are very sick. But yeah, he shared it with me in the hospital and talked to me about what was going on with that, and that if I wanted that as an option, it's there. And I had never thought about it, never really heard about it until that point. And it was a heavy combo. He stayed with me for almost 3 hours. We talked for a long time, and I give him credit because he did a hell of a job just being there in that moment and supporting me.
Yeah, that's really cool. 3 hours. I mean, yeah, for him to give you that kind of time.
And it was late. It was like, I mean, he rolled in, you know, 6:45 or so. I remember I was eating dinner, watching the tube. Hospital setup is decent at UCSD. Big TVs. When you get that single room, nice big TV. And, you know, decent setup for sure. Decent food. But yeah, he strolled in and he sat with me. And he was, at that time, he was more than being just my doctor. He was there for me as a person and as a human being. And I really, yeah, I just appreciate that. It was a heavy moment, profound, impactful.
Yeah, I feel like the most important case, or the most like notable case, is of Brittany Maynard.
And that, yeah,
she was like a catalyst for this thing even being legal in California.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's back up before we talk about Brittany, because she is someone who was certainly, like you said, a catalyst and really just a hero to people who are sick. Basically, Brittany, in 2015, since we're kind of already there, I'm sorry, it was 2014, she was a terminally ill Californian resident, and she wanted to use the End of Life Option Act, which was not allowed in California at the time. So she had to leave her home state and move to Oregon to receive that option. And this was the spark to get this movement really lit up and get going. Because after Brittany followed through and made that move and did use the medication, she kind of became the symbol for this whole movement and got the ball rolling. The next year, in 2015, is when legislation was passed to get the Death with Dignity, or the End of Life Option Act, passed. And we were also fortunate enough to talk with State Senator Susan Talamantes Eggman, who was absolutely instrumental in the passage of that bill back in 2015. So when you listen to episode 3, you'll get a chance to hear from her and directly from her regarding her experiences when this bill was being passed, as well as her background as a political figure.
Yeah, it's...
But really, I mean, this whole process, the Death with Dignity process and the idea dates back all the way to the 70s, and specifically in California, for example, in 1980, a man named Derek Humphrey established what was called the Hemlock Society in Santa Monica, and he was advocating for legal change and also gave information to others about how to die or aid in dying or death with dignity. And this whole organization grew to over 50,000 members. Another big piece in the early 80s was a woman named Elizabeth Bouvia. She was a quadriplegic, and she actually was believed to be one of the first people to sue a California hospital to let her die from stealth starvation. And she was receiving care, but she wanted to die. During that time, she was receiving comfort care, but she was basically trying to end her life due to her, you know, pretty horrible conditions. And that, you know, again, this whole idea dates back pretty far.
Because if a patient really wants, they could just refuse food and water, and that's one way to, like, hasten your death.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and just refusing all sorts of medical support, for sure. Back in 1992 was the first attempt in California to pass legislation, and that failed. So think about that, 92 to 2015, it took all that time to get legislation passed, and there was lots of people in the interim who were suffering from a pretty horrible terminal disease. I think it's important to at least have this as an option, and people, we recognize this is a very heavy topic. It's very difficult to discuss. We're talking life and death here. I think as people, that's one of the greatest questions. What happens when we die? And we all have wondered that at some point in our life. And if anything, hopefully this pod will get people thinking more about that piece. And I think maybe it'll generalize to their just everyday life and how important and valuable this stuff is and how none of it is a given and that there is no tomorrow, there are no guarantees. But I guess going back to death with dignity, there were other multiple attempts in California to pass the law. Oregon was the first state to pass an aid in dying law, and they did that, I think it was back in, it was back in 97, I believe, maybe even earlier. No, it was earlier than that. I think it was 92. Yes, 92. I think. But we'll have our co-producer find that out, find that information.
It went into effect October 27th, 1997.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, yeah, I was thinking in 92, Oregon State Senator, or Oregon Senator Frank Roberts made an attempt, but it narrowly failed. Anyways, so Oregon was able to pass a bill, and then many years later, California also was able to pass. And again, a lot of that was due to Brittany Maynard. You should check out her story. It's very, very impressive. She was a very impressive woman. So 2015, as we mentioned, that was when the real kind of fight and legislative process began. And it was going back and forth. In fact, on August 17th of 2015, Senator Eggman, along with some other representatives, were able to push the bill through on this. It was like a major healthcare law and bill that they were trying to pass at the time. And in episode 3, she actually refers back to this. They kind of mix it in with the healthcare piece, but different communities and organizations were trying to say that this wasn't healthcare, that this was more like, I forget how she had put it, based on a spiritual piece, maybe even related to that. And it essentially was shot down. But it was a fight, is what I'm getting at. It was a very, very long process. Even the day that it was signed into law, you can imagine there were tons of lawsuits against it, right, when it went into into action. And that brings us to on October 5th of 2015, California Governor Jerry Brown signed the End of Life Option Act. And with that signature, 39 million Californians were able to join the residents of Oregon, Washington, and Vermont in having that option if they were to be terminally ill and have less than 6 months to live, to end their life in a humane and dignified manner. That's another piece to this process, is there has to be certain doctors to agree that an individual has 6 months or less to live. And for me, I enrolled in, enrolled in this process December of 2020. So I'm coming up on a whole year that I've managed to beat that estimate. And doctors do their best. When we've talked with these different doctors, yeah, you'll hear from them and they'll say one thing we're not good at.
Was speaking about that.
Right. They'll say we're not good at predicting or knowing when people will pass. It just, there's not data really to support it, and they don't really know it. Right? We talk about the different pieces to what drives individuals, and are those things that can be measured? Your willpower, your fight, your internal drive? I don't know.
Yeah, the doctor we spoke to, and I'm not sure what episode number it's going to be yet, but I think it was Dr. Millard. He spoke about, like, I mean, you have to, because of laws and bureaucracy, you have to give a number, but that number is not really accurate, or they only have so much information, and doctors are not necessarily good at predicting patient outcomes like that.
Right. I would like to share the quote that Jerry Brown had said when he was signing the End of Life Option Act. He said, "I do not know what I would do if I were dying in prolonged and excruciating pain. I am certain, however, that it would be a comfort to be able to consider the options afforded by this bill. And I wouldn't deny that right to others." I thought that was a powerful thing. I don't think people recognize or realize what it's like to be in a situation and get to the end of having a terminal disease. Even I don't know what that's like yet. I'm not at the end of my time yet. And I'll tell you right now that I'm still, you know, having a hard time, and I am banged up, and I am hurting, and I don't feel good. And this ain't nothing yet compared to what's waiting for me with this disease.
Yeah, I think the politics of death with dignity are like interesting. The word suicide, which is like more of a politicized term, which carries like a value judgment and social stigma, is often used by like people that don't agree with it, and yeah, that's just I think a lot of colleges and medical, like I think the American Medical Association and the California Medical Association have now stopped using that word when it comes to death with dignity, and they call it assisted dying, assisted death, aid in dying. And yeah, I think it's important for people to like understand that there really is a distinction from people who are suicidal versus death with dignity.
Absolutely. And I believe you had shared with me when we were having discussion once, and it always stuck with me. One of the biggest differences between something like suicide and death with dignity or the End of Life Option Act is that when an individual is suicidal, they do not want to live anymore. They are making the choice to end their life. Whereas when a person is terminally ill, they generally do want to live and they want to keep going forward. Only they're forced into a horrific situation and don't have a choice. And knowing that that option is available just spares a tremendous amount of agony and suffering that I don't think anybody would want to experience.
And even having the option, because 1 in 3 patients end up never taking it at all, And even just having the option gives the person like a sense of control and a sense of comfort, I feel.
Certainly. And that, I think it ties into the social emotional piece. It does change your outlook and how you feel about your disease. At least it has for me. I do feel more comfortable. I feel more in control. I feel like I'll be able to decide when I've had enough, and I think I'll know when I've had enough. And knowing that that's an option to check out is good, because from all the people we've been talking with and the research I've done, it does not seem like a terrible way to go. And I would rather go out that way versus agony and suffering and writhing in pain as this disease just destroys my body.
Yeah. One of the things that stuck out with me after talking to all the people that you were like able to have conversations with is how the difference between hospice, or the line between hospice and death with dignity, or aid in dying, is actually very small. These lines, you know, I think most people that end up using the medicine actually are in hospice at the time.
Yes, that's true. And there are different hospice facilities who have different perspectives and feelings about it. In fact, we'll have a coordinator from a hospice facility on in a later episode who shares quite a bit about their experiences when managing and helping and supporting patients who are terminally ill and use this as an option. But yeah, when in hospice services, you basically elect to stop treating the disease. And the idea of hospice is to, I believe, basically make the individual as comfortable as possible as they are on their way out. And yeah. I'm in a position where, yeah, I could certainly go that route and start the hospice thing. And in fact, I do need to do diligence and kind of check out some different facilities. But part of me worries that if I do that, and it might sound silly, but I do worry that if I do that, there's going to be a part of me that is more, not accepting, but I don't want to hasten the process of my death. And I don't want any part of me, whether it's subconscious or not, to know or to, I guess, speed this up.
You're not ready to give up the quote-unquote fight.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. That's probably the best way of looking at it. I think I'll know when it's time to use those services. And for whatever reason, I do believe people know when it's time to go. And I don't know when that's going to be for me, but I know that I'm going to keep grinding and doing whatever the hell I can to stay up and stay alive for as long as I can. And someday it'll happen and it will be okay. And it will be a relief for in a way, a very big relief for me, because I'll be honest that this disease, it's very taxing. It's very hard to have cancer and it requires so much.
Yeah. And like really the thing that stuck out to me is like, for me, you know, people being opposed to this, like we've learned so much by talking to, you know, people, all the people that we talked to on the podcast. It seems like most people that are opposed to this is for like a religious reason that they have, and they're trying to kind of project, or maybe, you know, whatever they think it's supposed to be at the end of life. They're like trying to have other people feel the same way and deprive them of an option that kind of reduces unnecessary suffering and loss of like autonomy.
I agree, and you'll hear from the stories and the guests that we have, and they'll share experiences, but certainly the religion piece seems like it's a big influence for some individuals, especially for those who don't agree with it. It always seems to go back to the theology. And it's okay, you don't have to agree with it, but I think holding empathy is so important, and sometimes I think, I don't know if when people don't agree with stuff like this, I don't know how much experience they've had with something like cancer or terminal disease, or even the people around them. Because it just seems like you would want what's best for your loved one, and sometimes what's best is checking out, and sometimes it means, I think in this situation, people should have the option to make that decision on their own. We have a plan for almost everything in life, right? We have an exit plan to like everything, a transition plan, except for death. No one wants to think and talk about this. And I get it. It's kind of like the cancer thing. You don't want to sit around talking about cancer or death all day, right? Like, that's not that fun. That's not a pleasant dinner party. But in certain situations, it's very important to discuss, and it's important to reflect and know that we aren't invincible. We all share this commonality in that we will have a birth and we will have a death. That is a guarantee.
Death is undefeated.
It certainly is. And it eventually, Father Time, it catches up with us all. And so again, I'm not saying it's something we need to talk about all the time or every day or whatever, but it's, I do believe that I've grown as a person from these discussions, and I've felt more comfortable with where I'm going due to this podcast and the idea of death with dignity and going through that process. And for odd as it is, and this will sound very odd to say, and it's the ultimate paradox in my life, but for as sick as I am, I'm also, I don't think I've ever been happier in my life with what I've been doing. And yeah, what I've been doing. We've had some great times over the last few years. And
for sure,
it was the ultimate kind of kick in the teeth getting this disease. But it wakes you up and helps you learn just what's important. And it's sad that it took this for me to get to that point. But that's the trade-off that needed to happen. And I don't know, you just don't know where you'd be. Had I not gotten sick, I'm not sure where I would end up. I think I might have, I look back at who I was at that time and the stuff I was doing, and I think had I not been sick, I probably wouldn't have gone, not necessarily down the right road, but I think I would have been in a worse situation. Maybe a worse situation in a way. It sounds odd to say, but maybe we'll save that for a different episode. But yeah, ultimately,
I think we can all benefit. We don't have to think about it all the time, but just understanding that life is not forever.
Yeah, totally.
It doesn't last forever.
Totally.
Yeah, I feel like we covered death with dignity, at least like the overarching stuff.
Yeah, and this is, again, just the first episode. Basically, people, the idea of this podcast is to share my experiences as a terminal cancer patient and how death with dignity was presented as an option. It's not something that's discussed often, I think, in the medical community. It's something that isn't really offered in many states in our country.
Many physicians don't even know about it.
Correct. And so we figured that let's try to make something good happen from all of this. And maybe this is that piece that will be good.
Yeah. Put your
voice out. And if nothing else, yeah, it's been cathartic. Like I said, I've learned a lot about myself over the years from being sick as well as from this podcast alone. And I think that if no one listens to it, that's okay, because again, it's been a hell of an experience and journey meeting with these different people and individuals, hearing these different perspectives, and kind of just reflecting on my own path. So it's been good. It's been good all the way around. And we hope that we can continue to learn and talk about those three pieces that we mentioned before, the different physical elements, social, emotional, and spiritual pieces that are correlated to this whole process and the End of Life Option Act, or the idea of death with dignity. We've got all sorts of different guests coming on, medical professionals, political figures, family, maybe some friends. So a lot to talk about, people. And we're really thankful for you listening.
Yeah, this is a really cool project. And I think anybody that joins in will see that.
Yeah, I hope so. And we've got all the available information out there for you. If you want to reach out at all and send a Twitter message or shoot a DM or whatever they say, do it up. We're here. We'd love to hear from you. And any feedback is appreciated. Again, Twitter, emails, all that good stuff is on there. We've got a website and all that jazz. I've also got a different blog that's available related to my experiences with cancer and my cultivation as a gardener. So that's kind of fun. But I'd say overall we covered it. It's a pretty good first episode.
Yeah.
And we thank all of you guys for listening. The fun thing about this podcast piece is it's a discussion. So sometimes we waver with where we're going, but I think ultimately we are pretty structured with what we want to talk about. And we hope that we can keep providing some good episodes and content for you to enjoy and learn from and hopefully grow from as well as an individual.
For sure.
Thanks, friends. We love you.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk soon.